Welcome to Citizens Climate University, a weekly webinar program on Citizens Climate Lobbies that provides CCL supporters like you and I with access to in-depth training opportunities on topics relating to climate change and effective climate advocacy. I'm your host, Brett Cease, and tonight's topic is understanding updates to Canada's carbon fee and dividend policy. We're going to be joined by CCI's Program Director, Kathy Orlando, and Clean Prosperity's Executive Director, Michael Bernstein, for a training that's going to update attendees on helping understand the emerging updates to Canada's carbon fee and dividend policy. Michael Bernstein is Clean Prosperity's Executive Director as a trained economist and successful business executive. Michael joined Clean Prosperity in 2018. His career has spanned business, management, consulting, international development, and politics. And prior to Clean Prosperity, Michael was the CEO of Mama Earth Organics, a small business that delivered organic produce from local farms to families around the Greater Toronto Area. I'll have a chance to let Kathy tell a little bit more about that relationship, especially that CCL Canada has nurtured throughout the years with Clean Prosperity. But let me quickly introduce Kathy as well. Kathy Orlando works as Citizens Climate International's Program Director, where within an exceptional team, she creates the framework to empower volunteers throughout the world to build political will for evidence-based climate action in over 60 different countries. Kathy's been managing adult volunteers online since 2004, is a published scientist, and started CCL's first international chapter back in September of 2010, has been going full steam ever since. And with that, I will spotlight you, Kathy. We are so grateful for all of you being on the line, and the floor is yours.
Well, thank you for that wonderful introduction, and I won't take much time. I just wanted to take a moment to contextualize the relationship between Citizens Climate Lobby Canada and Clean Prosperity. Citizens Climate Lobby Canada is the grassroots mobilization for carbon pricing for the most part, and Clean Prosperity is the grass tops mobilization, and we occupy two very separate and unique niches within the climate movement in Canada, but so complementary. And I'm very grateful for the work that Clean Prosperity has done. And they've worked with us over the years. In 2014, they joined us. The members then joined us in Washington, D.C. when we went to lobby there. And between 2016 and 2018, their former executive director presented at every single Citizens Climate Lobby event we had. We leaned quite heavily on their research. They are just a remarkable carbon pricing research organization. Very grateful for their work. And you know, this relationship continues with Michael now at the helm, and the work that they've been doing is fueling our volunteers here in Canada with great information. And we're very grateful to have them helping us in Canada and here tonight to help you as well. So thank you. Michael, the floor is yours.
Hey, thanks so much, Kathy, and thanks, Brett, and thanks to everybody for coming. It's really an honor to be able to be here with all of you. I've known about CCL's work for a number of years now, and have always been just really impressed and encouraged by the tremendous work you've done. I've had a chance to go down to DC and meet with some of the folks who've been in DC and be part of I didn't go on to the Hill, but I was there during a lobby day and saw what was done. So really great to be with all of you. And what I'm gonna do is spend the next 20 or so minutes talking about carbon pricing in Canada. I'll try to give you some detail without going all the way through, you know, every detail, and then leave enough time for us all to talk, because really look forward to your questions and to the dialogue. So with that said, let me share my screen here, and hopefully everybody can see it. If for any reason you can't, I see a thumbs up, so that's always a good sign. So let's talk through this. Let's see if I can just, last trick here is advancing through the slides. There we go. So I'm going to cover a number of different topics. I'm just going to talk through the federal and provincial relationship and how carbon pricing works across the country. Tell you a little bit about how the tax and rebate design works in Canada. We'll talk a little bit about the large industrial emitters, talk about the new climate plan that was announced in December, so fairly recently, and then talk a little bit about what does that all mean? What are the emissions impacts of the plan? And how might that relate to maybe adding on a border carbon adjustment? So those are kind of the topics that I want to run through with you all. I think the headline here is, you know, Canada has a very ambitious climate or carbon pricing plan, definitely one of perhaps arguably the most ambitious climate and carbon pricing plan, not climate plan, but carbon pricing plan and trajectory in the world, if it's fully implemented. So and unlike some other carbon pricing schemes in the world, that policy has survived at least one election now federally, and I think is an important counter example to the narrative that had emerged over recent years that, you know, carbon pricing might be a good policy in theory, but it was politically very treacherous for politicians who chose to adopt it. You know, you heard a lot of that. I'm sure many of you would be familiar with it coming out of the yellow vest protests in France. I don't believe that's correct or fair, but I think that was the narrative that came out of it. So I think Canada, you know, I think of the Canadian policy not only as an effective policy that is going to have a lot of impact on emissions in Canada, but our hope really is that it can be a example for other countries, including our neighbors to the US, of course, of how you can design a policy with elements that make it politically acceptable and supportable. And it, as you'll see, and as many of you may know, it actually mirrors fairly closely some of the policies that you all have been advocating for across the United States. So, I think, you know, as you will probably be familiar with, the headline on the carbon tax is that it is going up to $170 per ton, 170 Canadian, of course, per ton over the next 10 years. It is currently, as I'll talk about in a minute, at $30 a ton. Yeah, I think I'll just actually skip over the summary and get right into the details of it. To go to the next slide, the first thing I think to understand about the policy is that it is a backstop policy. So the federal government has said, look, we want each province to either come up with their own plan that involves a price escalation that looks like this. So started at $20 per ton in 2019, and then went up $10 a ton each year until 2022. So $20 to $50 over 4 years. And then after 2022, it's going to continue at $15 per ton per year through 2030. That gets you to the 170. But instead of the federal government imposing that on each province, what it said was you have the choice to come up with a system of your own design. It could be a carbon tax. It could be a cap and trade system. And what you need to show us as the federal government is that your system is going to get the same amount of emissions reductions as our system would have gotten if we put it in place in your province. And the provinces have done different things with that. Some provinces already, in fact, had their own system. As many of you would know, BC, for example, has had a carbon price of its own since 2008. Quebec had a cap and trade system since, I believe it's 2013. And so those provinces kept their own systems, and other provinces made different choices. Some imposed a carbon tax. I don't believe any designed, well, I guess maybe Newfoundland did. So most designed a carbon tax, some adopted a cap and trade, and others just said, you know what, we disagree with this policy. We're going to refuse essentially to do anything about it. And for those provinces who did that, the federal system kicked in as a backstop in those provinces. And so of the 10 Canadian provinces right now, you have 4 provinces who are actually under the federal carbon tax system. It happens to be some of the most populated provinces, like Ontario, where I am today and where Kathy is. And actually it's most of the middle of the country that is under the carbon tax regime. So I think that's what I'll, so what you end up with, if I actually go to the next slide here, is you end up with a bit of a patchwork of policies that looks like this. So you see the dark blue is the federal system. And then you have various colors for other kinds of systems in the other provinces, all which have been deemed to be equivalent to the federal system in terms of emissions impact. The other thing to point out about the system is that, you know, there are really two systems operating at once, even though we often talk about it as the federal carbon price. Those two systems are, one is one that applies to industrial emitters. So these are facilities that are emitting more than 50,000 tons of carbon per year. And then there's a separate system that's often called the fuel levy or the retail tax, and that essentially applies to everybody else except these big industrial emitters. So the retail side is the easier one to understand. It looks more like the proposals that CCL has advocated for, and it's a straight price on combustion of fossil fuels, whether that be gasoline, natural gas for home heating, et cetera. And that money is then recycled back to Canadians. And I'll talk a little bit more about how that recycling works in a second. But on the industrial side, the system is pretty interesting. It is considered an output-based pricing system. And the way that works is it is not based on the total number of tons of emissions, of carbon emissions that a facility produces, but instead it's based on the emissions intensity of production. So if you're a steel mill, as an example, the way your charge would work is you are first compared against all other steel mills in the country based on how much carbon per ton of steel you're producing. That's the emissions intensity itself. So tons of carbon per unit of output, in this case, tons of steel. So you're compared against your peers, and then there's a stringency factor that's applied, which is typically 80%. So to keep it simple, imagine all the steel mills, we look at all of the tons of carbon they emitted, we divide it by the total amount of steel produced, and we get an average to say, look, there's 2 tons of carbon, just to use an illustrative figure, this isn't the precise number, there's 2 tons of carbon that are emitted for every ton of steel produced. And then the federal government says, okay, we're gonna put the threshold at 80% of that number. So we're gonna multiply that 2 tons of carbon by 80%, which comes out to, I think, 1.6, if I'm doing my math correctly, 1.6 tons of carbon. And anything below 1.6 tons per ton of steel, you're off the hook, right? You don't have to pay a price for any emissions below that 1.6. But if you emit 2.6 tons for every ton of steel, well, that extra ton, right, that 1 ton that exceeded that threshold of 1.6, you've got to pay the price on that 1 ton of carbon. So why do they do that? The basic logic for that is that it's a concern about carbon leakage, which I'm assuming is a term that folks on this call will have heard. But the essence of that for anyone who hasn't is, you know, the government has decided, and I tend to think it's quite a logical decision, that if we're applying a carbon levy on our steel mills, and the end result of that steel mill moves outside of Canada and continues to produce steel, but just not in Canada because of the costs we've imposed, well, we've actually done nothing for the climate because that ton is still being produced. But what we have done is chase jobs and economic activity out of the country. You know, the long-term and better solution for that, as we'll get into later, is border carbon adjustments. But until we have that in place, this is the interim solution that is deemed to still impose a charge on those industrial emitters, because there's still a carbon tax that's applied. And if they find efficiencies or reduce their carbon output, they are going to save the equivalent of $30 a ton in today's case, or in 2030, they would have saved $170 a ton by reducing emissions. So they still have that incentive, but they're paying less overall, and thus the potential risk of them fleeing due to the charge has been mitigated. At least that's the goal of that design. So so those are the basic, I think, parameters to understand as you're starting to think through the carbon pricing design in Canada. You've got a federal system with different policies in different provinces, and the federal system only in provinces who have either willingly said, you know what, we'd rather have a federal system, or provinces who are holdouts to say, forget it, we don't want to do this, and the governments imposed it. That's the first big piece. And the second is a distinction between big industrial emitters and everybody else, small businesses, households, et cetera. Okay, so moving along, let's talk a little bit about how the revenue is used. I think the key here in Canada, and I know this is something that CCL supports too, is this is a revenue neutral carbon pricing regime. 90% of the funds that are collected under the fuel levy. So we're putting the industrial system aside now, but we're talking about the retail levy. Is 90% of that money goes back to Canadian households in the form of a tax credit. So every year when you file your taxes, there's a whole bunch of deductions and different allocations. And as part of that, the government will allocate you, depending on your size of household, a certain amount of money. I've actually shown, and I don't know how, hopefully it's not too small for folks on the screen, but you can see a graphic here on the right hand side of the slide that shows what this looks like for a family of four in Ontario. And it starts to be real money. You can see this year it's going to be $600 for a family of four. That's going to rise each year, of course, as the carbon tax continues to escalate. And over the course of the next decade, we calculate that a family of four would receive almost $14,000 Canadian. So that's significant money, and of course something that can both offset costs and start to help people, if they're aware of it, make investments in things that were going to reduce their carbon footprint in the future. So that's been a really, really important part of the policy. And I would argue one of the reasons why carbon pricing is a popular policy in Canada for the most part. When it's pulled, particularly in places like Ontario, we find that support for the policy, depending on how you question and other things, is anywhere from 50 to 65% of people who support it. Not overwhelming, but still a majority to a decent majority. And then you have something like 25, 30% who are opposed. So it's, at worst, a 50% support, 30% opposed issue. And I think this idea of it being revenue neutral is a really critical part of that, as of course is, just growing concern about climate change. Now, let's talk, we've talked about the 90% of revenue that goes to households. The remaining 10% is split up in two different ways. So you've got 7% of the money going to small businesses, but in the form of energy efficiency grants. So you've got to apply for these grants if you want to put an insulation or change out your boiler, and the federal government will provide a partial payment, 40, 50, 60%, depending on some details that probably we don't need to get into here, for that investment and upgrade in energy efficiency. So that's 7%. And then the final 3% is reserved for what we call the mush sector. I don't know if that's a term that you use as well, but it basically means municipalities, universities, schools, hospitals, indigenous communities. So think of this in short form as nonprofits. And the money is also granted there for energy efficiency programs. Actually, what they do is they cycle the money every year. So one year, the money, that whole 3% goes to schools. The next year, the whole 3% goes to hospitals, just because it starts to be small dollars and it's inefficient, kind of fully spread it out every year. One of the things that we've been pushing for and that CCL Canada has been pushing for, and we actually have managed to get mostly through now in the December announcement, because as I indicated before, there have been some recent changes, which we're going to come to in a minute. But one of the really exciting things for folks like I think on this call is that there is going to be a quarterly payment issued starting in 2022. So instead of a tax credit, which is still great, but the reality is in our polling, we found over and over that only 1/3 of people could correctly identify that the money is going back to households right now, despite the fact that people have already been receiving this. Only 1/3 of people know about it right now, which just speaks to how challenging it is to break through to people. But you know what people do notice is checks that they get in the mail, or money that just keeps showing up in their bank account. And so we're really happy about the decision the federal government has made here to issue these quarterly payments. We think that's going to build knowledge of the rebates. And what we find, as you probably won't be surprised to learn, is that as soon as you tell people that there's a rebate, even before you've told them anything about their own specific circumstance, whether they're going to get more money back than they pay or how much they're even going to get, but as soon as you just tell them, look, all the money is going back to households and businesses, support goes up dramatically for the policy. It often goes from about 50% to 70%, 55 to 75%. Because this just unlocks the concern or the reservation that some people have, even if they might want to otherwise support the policy, that, hey, this is going to cost me money. And understandably, you know, I'm concerned about my family budget and therefore I'm hesitant about the policy. So we think that's a big value driver. There are, I guess the last point on this slide, since we have framed this a technical briefing, I will go into a few extra technical details here, is that there are a few exemptions to this policy. It generally applies across the whole economy. It's a very broadly applied tax, the broadest one that I'm aware of in the entire world. But there a couple of exemptions are, for example, there are certain fuels like diesel that is used for on-farm activities is exempt from the carbon tax. In northern communities where they don't have access to road transport, aviation is exempted in those communities because I guess for somewhat obvious reasons. And same thing goes for diesel generation in those communities where they don't actually have alternatives. But it applies with those few caveats basically to all economic activity. Okay, so moving on, I've kind of already given you the lowdown on the industrial pricing system. And so, you know, there's a few backup details here about this. The only thing I think I didn't necessarily mention, so I'll just quickly flag it here, is that I did say that the threshold was 50,000 tons, but there is the option for smaller facilities to opt into this program all the way down to 10,000 tons. So the program is somewhat flexible. And maybe the other thing I'll mention, though I don't have it in my slides, is that, you know, we have interestingly seen a consensus now across the country on industrial pricing policies. So even though we are still in the midst of a fairly healthy disagreement among the parties on whether to have a consumer carbon price. And it's generally the Liberal Party who's in support, as well as the Greens and the NDP. So most of the left of center parties, whereas the right of center party, our conservative party, is against the consumer price. That is actually not true on the industrial side. Both the federal conservatives and a number of provincial conservative governments who are fighting the consumer carbon tax in court have either accepted the federal government's industrial pricing system, or in most cases have adopted their own system that looks remarkably similar to the federal system. So we actually do have really an emerging consensus in our country around industrial pricing, which is real progress. And you know, that is about a third of the emissions in Canada that are under this industrial pricing system. So, you know, we can't forget about those other two thirds, there's no question, but at least we have some cross-partisan consensus on the one-third and hopefully stable policy for that reason. So moving forward, let's talk a little bit about the new plan that was announced. You know, the way this policy was put into place is it was enacted in the first term of the Trudeau government in 2018, but when the government announced the policy after negotiations with the provinces, the pricing schedule was only set to go up to $50 a ton by 2022, and that was the signature part of a broader climate policy. But even that broader climate policy only got, depending on how you make the assumptions, about two-thirds of the way to Canada's Paris target, which is clearly insufficient just on its own, but let alone trying to get to net zero by 2050, it would be nowhere near sufficient. So in December, the government came up with an enhanced climate plan that raised the ambition on a number of different fronts. But again, the centerpiece of the policy was the carbon tax. And I think much to the government's credit, you know, they were quite brave and quite bold about the way they used carbon pricing. And they decided not only to continue to escalate the price in the midst of what we're all experiencing right now, which is, you know, the challenges around COVID, but in fact, they raised the ante and they increased the price escalation, the price ramp from what was $10 a ton to $15 a ton, as I had said earlier. And I also talked about the quarterly payments. And then another piece of it is that they increased the stringency of the industrial pricing program. So that when I talked about the 80% stringency before, they're going to continue to ratchet that up. So in other words, more of the emissions per ton of steel would actually be charged. You know, there's a number of other elements of that plan as well. There's a variety of regulations, which we can go into a little bit in the Q&A if folks are interested, but it's things like a clean fuel standard, which mandates how much of the fuel of gasoline needs to be produced using, or actually really what it is dictating how much, I guess, how much carbon can be in each liter of fuel. There was a whole series of investments that the government pledged to make in areas that you'd likely expect, from public transit to hydrogen, to, you know, a number of other areas, building out transmission lines, things of that nature. And then, you know, I think related to this topic around carbon pricing, the government has in the last few months signaled its intention to try to develop a border carbon adjustment policy. This has showed up in a number of government documents, a little bit out of the blue, but it's come mainly, after the election of Joe Biden in the United States. And I know from talking to folks in the government that was a major factor for them in thinking that they could move to this policy, because as much as I think folks who design policy in the federal government around climate recognize the value of a border carbon adjustment, the reality is for a country like ours that's so dependent on the trade relationship with the United States, where we are really the, you know, frankly, the small partner in that relationship, it's just not very practical for us to develop unilaterally a border carbon adjustment, or at least that's been the thinking up to now. But given that there seems to be a new posture in terms of climate ambition in the United States, I think there's a number of areas in which Canada is looking at how our country can develop a strategic alliance on climate action with your country, with the United States. And there's a number of areas, from fuel economy standards to methane regulations, that are part of that. But one piece of that is a border carbon adjustment, and the idea, could we create some sort of common policy? And of course, critically for Canada, I think, would be to try to get some reciprocity in the cross-border relationship between our two countries, so we don't see any border carbon fees applied to Canadian goods from the US or vice versa. Just moving along, and I see we're at about 8:30, so I'm going to try to, I'll probably try to wrap up in the next couple of minutes and take questions. This is a pretty dense slide, so I wouldn't worry too much about the numbers, but really this is just saying, you know, we've run some modeling to try to understand what are the impacts of Canada's carbon pricing system as it relates to trying to get both to our 2030 climate target and to the net zero emissions goal. We actually did this prior to the government making their announcement, which is why we see a bunch of scenarios. There's, you know, three rows with three different scenarios here, but let me focus on the last row at the bottom, which most closely mirrors what the government has announced. You know, and basically the punchline of this is that what we find is that this pricing policy could generate about, it's going to take us well beyond our Paris target. So it's going to generate an additional 159 megatons of reductions by 2030. To put that in context, we have about 700 megatons of emissions in the whole country right now. And it will get us well past our 2030 target. And then as it pertains to net zero, we find that this policy could get us about 60% of the way to net zero emissions. So that's that's really, really big, of course. Like, that's an incredibly important start. It's clearly not the whole way. So the point is that I think part of what we were doing in this report was to try to get beyond what we find is a bit of a tired debate that we're having in Canada, and perhaps it's happening in the US too, around should we have a carbon tax? You know, some people saying, look, carbon tax is the only policy and is the answer to everything. And others saying, no, we shouldn't have a carbon tax. You know, from our view, we believe a carbon tax should be the centerpiece of a climate plan. It's going to be an incredibly powerful part of it, a critical part of it, probably the biggest, almost for sure, the most important part of it. But there are still a lot of other investments that are going to need to be made to complement that policy. And we started in this report, and we can talk about this more in the discussion if people want, to say, you know, where does pricing work really well? What are the areas where we need to put in place other kinds of investments or regulations to complement it? I think I'll skip past this because it's fairly technical. We can go over it if anyone actually wants. And then I'll just conclude with this slide and just talk a little bit more about border carbon adjustments. I mean, I guess I did kind of already give you a lot of the punchlines here, but just scanning the slide, I just want to see if I missed anything. And I think maybe the only other thing I'll mention here is that I think this is going to take some time. The federal government is interested in this, but I think most folks are thinking this is 2 to 3 years away at best. That would be probably the fastest. This may be something that takes 4, 5, 6 years to fully develop. It's still unclear what shape that will take. And of course, other countries like the EU, as you'll likely know, are trying to grapple with that as well. What they want to apply a border carbon tax, but is it going to apply to all goods? Is it going to only be a select set of goods at the beginning, you know, the steels and cements and things of that nature at first? It's still too early to say in Canada. In fact, there's been fairly, I would say fairly minimal thinking yet about this. I think this is more something that the government knows they need to sort out. And I think they're eager to start to do that in partnership with their US counterparts. And so I expect that there will be some discussions between the countries in the coming months to try to map that out. We at Clean Prosperity are doing our own research on this in partnership with another group in Canada to try to lay out some of the different design options. But I don't think this is something that's going to happen right away. And of course, in Canadian climate policy, one of the factors that's always on the minds of folks is the oil and gas industry here, right? We have a big oil and gas industry. We are a resource intensive economy. And so politicians are constantly thinking about that. What are going to be the impacts on that sector? And the understandable concerns about, you know, workers in that sector in particular. So, you know, I think that's where I'll probably stop here. The report itself, which I know is linked earlier, does talk a lot about, which I haven't talked about here, but does talk a lot about some of the technology that we think can be enabled through this increased carbon price. We think at the trajectory that the government is committed to, you know, all carbon capture and storage technology essentially becomes profitable. We also think that the price will enable investments in the carbon removal and carbon management sector, things like direct air capture, carbon utilization products, and clean tech more broadly. So we could talk a little bit about that in discussion too, if folks are interested, but let me stop there and just see what questions and comments you have.
Bravo. Thank you so much, Michael. I'm going to round our listeners, for those that are interested in hearing the in-depth conversation that you and Kathy are about to have during Q&A, to click on the link featured in the description below this actual blog to find that. But to help shorten this episode, we're also putting a link. If people would like to find the full policy report from Clean Prosperity and a plan to reach net zero, we're going to put that in the liner notes for this episode as well. And we'll also put a link where you can find out more information on CCL Community. And again, just want to plug how incredibly grateful we are, Michael, for your involvement and perspective and just your business savvy, your policy savvy, and really being able to highlight and help all of us on stateside understand the updates that are happening in Canada's carbon dividends plan. So for those that want to stay on for Q&A, you can just click the link in the description field to go to that next video. We hope that you find this training empowering and informational, and look forward to hearing your feedback. Thanks again, everyone, and have a wonderful night.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Citizens Climate Lobby's training program. You can tune into more episodes anywhere podcasts are available. Inspired by what you heard today? Join Citizens Climate Lobby to advocate for bipartisan climate solutions. Go to community.citizensclimate.org to find more trainings, resources, your local chapter, national action teams, discussion forums, and more. Be sure to like our Facebook page and follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Citizens Climate. We also invite all of our listeners to subscribe to our YouTube channel for more inspiration. And together, we are creating the political will for a livable world.